Hello and welcome to the Grazier's Grapevine, where we hold lively discussions on all things grazing. I'm your host, Jen Albright. This podcast is brought to you by the Pennsylvania Grazing Lands Coalition, the Capital RCND, the Mountains to Bay Grazing Alliance, as well as the National Fish and Wildlife Federation and its funders. Hi, friends. So, I hope you enjoyed the previous episode with Beau Ramsberg. Today, you are going to hear the second installment from the Franklin County Graziers Winter Meeting that took place on the 16th. And today, you'll hear from Greg Braun. He is a multi-generational farmer, and he owns and operates the Big Spring Farm in Allen County, Kentucky. So after this podcast, then we'll head back into our series on the cover crop grazing project. So hope you enjoy.
The photo on your left is my dad was running the whole operation together, and we were running about 300 cows, and they're not all pictured there, but 300 cows, and it's just a cattle operation, and we'd rotate about every, week to 2 weeks, and tendency was to graze a little long and graze a little short, so we didn't get all the benefits from the grazing management, but at the time it was the best we knew. The photo on the right is more current, and it's just running down the county road, moving to another paddock, and do that. It's not a lot of traffic until we move them, and then it's a big traffic jam. So anyway, this is rated R for, there is a sex scene in here, but I will warn you when it's coming up, so don't be too surprised by that. I like for everybody to have a goal, and this is mine listed here, and the goal for your operation, this is based on holistic management, but there's three parts to it, and one is what's your quality of life? What do you want to get out of life? It might be church, it might be family, it could be fishing, it could be whatever it is. The next one is what do you want to do with the land? And then the third part is what's your vision? And I encourage you, if you haven't already done it, to write one down. Write a goal down, and all decisions are based on your goal. You're not going to get there unless you think about it. You know, it can be bouncing around in your head, but when you go to buy a piece of equipment, you need to think, is this reaching my goal or not? And it may be, but it may not be. So it's good to have it written down. And if there's more than one person involved in the operation, one may want to write it, and the other one edit it. So anyway, my goal for my farm, since kind of small type there, is a healthy, low-stress, low-cost grazing operation that is productive, improves the environment and life, while being consistently profitable. It's kind of vague, but it's what I got. And we move on through. So multi-species grazing, running the animals together. You know, why would we do that? More weed control, more nutrient cycling. They eat different varied diets. They don't share the same parasites, so they're vacuums for each other's parasites. There was some research done at Idaho State that showed by adding sheep to a cattle operation, you increase meat production 24%. By adding cattle to a sheep operation, you only added 9%. So it shows how efficient the sheep are. Small ruminants, both sheep and goats, they can be bred at like 10 months of age. Their gestation is like 5 months. So you can see the turnover is like really quick, like half the time of cattle. There's not a more efficient grazing animal than sheep. Well, there is, but they're wildlife. And I can't think of what the name of those are. But so increased income, increased cash flow, but with any new venture comes a little more labor, right? And it can be fun and entertaining. If it's not, then get out of it. You know, like goats. That's why I decreased my goat numbers. I wasn't having as much fun with them. That's another picture in the bottom land, and it's grazing some annuals there. It had been cropped for some time, and just in transition due to herbicides and other things. I like to go to annuals going from a crop instead of going straight to a perennial, because some of the herbicides can have quite a carryover. I'll show a few pictures here. There's Johnson grass and orchard grass and fescue mixed stand, and then there's my typical cross fence of polywires. I use three strands. Some people get by with one strand of polywire. You have to be very judicious in culling if you're going to go to one strand, and you have to rotate at least daily and make sure that they have plenty to eat. Looking at diversity, that's a dung fly. It's a beneficial insect. The little brown flies see them in early spring, sometimes late fall. That's a walk-through fly trap. That technology was developed in the 50s, and they did studies and research, and it kept flies at an economically sustainable rate. What it is like a mini-trap. There's two screens in there. One, the flies can get through, but they can't find their way back out, and the other screen keeps them in there. And I'll have that positioned at water points, and the animals have to go through it to get water. And more on diversity, I'll plant sunflowers and any number of things. Buckwheat and sunflowers are in almost every mix, even though they might not last that long, like in a fall mix. If I plant in September, I'll still put buckwheat and sunflowers in there. And, you know, buckwheat will make a bloom in, 40 days or so, and sunflowers about 45 or 60, depending on which variety. Usually I use the black oil, but it's for the diversity in root systems and diversity in the diet. There's a mix there with some chicory and brassicas and vetch and brome. I like it's another name for it, rescue grass. Or prairie brome grass, which is New Zealand prairie brome grass, which Matua. Some of you probably planted some Matua. It's a high quality grass. It grows well in the shade too. Anyway, a lot of diversity. There's a little alfalfa in that. That's a crabgrass. That's a, let's see, that one is Quick and Big, I believe, developed by Dalrymple out in Oklahoma. Noble Foundation. Some crimson clover and some winter peas, offspring winter peas, and some winter annuals. White clover. White clover is higher quality than alfalfa because the little leaf of the, I'm trying to think of the name, but anyway, the stem that's supporting that leaf is really part of the leaf. It's not a stem. So it's high quality. White clover is hard to beat. And Ladinas is what I prefer. You can get too much clover, you know, it can smother things out. So need graze a little higher, and you can shade it a little bit. So you just got to watch your quantity. Here's something I tried this last year, and it worked really well. Grow zucchini in the pasture. The animals don't even eat it. None of the animals eat the zucchini. Now, every once in a while, you lose a fruit, but those vines were there all summer, and they won't meet organic standards because you're not supposed to put manure on within so many days. I think it's 120 days. But anyway, just for home use, zucchini in the pasture, and it's a cucurbit. It's a diversity in the plant community, adding different root exudates and root structure to the system. Doesn't take many zucchini to add some diversity out there. Some red clover, milkweed, you know, they do carry a little toxicity. This is butterfly milkweed, but they are good for the monarchs and all. If I'm mowing a pasture, I'll mow around them. Yeah, if they were taking over big areas, I might mow them out, some of them out. But in general, I recommend going around them. And, you know, toxins are also medicine if they're taken in small doses. So I think there's some benefits there. I've never seen any animals that I thought were impacted by milkweed, whether it's common milkweed or butterfly, any of the milkweeds. There's your common milkweed there. I heard an entomologist speak one time, and he was talking about all the different butterflies and how they had associations with different plants. And I told him, you know, I see a lot of butterflies around manure piles. And he said, yeah, they're after the protein. So something you don't maybe see that often or think about, but I'm a manureologist. I'm always watching manure. So the prairie coneflower, I like it for diversity of plant. I don't like, and now it's great for bees, and I try to think of life in general because that's part of my goal is I want to improve life. This is wing stem. It has a little flange on the stem. Crown's beard's another name for it. It's good for bees and pollinators because it blooms in late summer. However, stock don't like it well. So it's a plant that I'm combating all the time, and it's a perennial. Perennials are hard to beat with grazing management if they don't eat them. They're increasers. If the animals don't eat them, they have the upper hand. They've got more leaf area, they go to seed, all those things. So we have to try to shade those out or stomp them or do something. It's a great place to put the mineral to get rid of those. I also like diversity. I plant trees. I plant varies year to year, but 100 trees average a year. I plant chestnuts for shade and plant some fruit trees around, use cages to protect them. But I'm not do filling the fields with trees, but I am into silvopasture. All right, so evolution of my farm from when we had just the cows and went to goats and then to sheep. And first off, we had a lot of single-strand wire for cross-fencing around the farm, and we would just add more wires. And it might be, usually for permanent fencing, it would be 4 strands with small remnants. Usually they go under, not over. If they jump a fence, then they probably need to jump on a truck. So they're a problem animal. Usually I won't make the bottom strand hot because that's where you're prone to more shorts. So until there's an issue, then I can make it hot. What else? We went from we'll start with the animals in the hub. And the hub is where the pastures come together. In this room, if all the tables were fences, then the hub would be this center out, because that's the joint area. And that's where that's a key point. It's good for lots of things. It's good for the corral. It could be good for feeding. It could be good for a water point. There's all kinds of uses of that hub. So I had to put more emphasis on that, and you need stronger fences in that hub area because that's where the pressure is, right? So also we don't make any hay on the farm. Bring in all the hay because it's bringing in nutrients. And there's, in a roll of hay, if it's 1,000 pounds, there's about $30 worth of N, P, and K. $20 to $30 depending on the price of fertilizer. So we look at that as it's still not like, you don't want to build the farm with hay unless you need the hay. You don't want to just be buying hay to build fertility. So current inventory, I'm running about 180 ewes. I'm decreasing the sheep flock because I market everything through River Cottage Farm, and that's my partner runs that, and so we've got more demand for beef, so we're increasing our beef numbers and keeping them longer because we're finishing cattle and finishing all the animals. So I'm decreasing my sheep numbers right now. I run about 40 cows, and like I say, those finishing animals become like another cow because they're about 1,200 pounds when they're finished. And we've got about 27 hogs right now. We've started running hogs. And this seems odd, but I'm using hogs to convert some woods over to pasture, where in the past I would have used goats in there to do it. So the hogs are doing it through tillage. Now, I'm the first to admit that animals can be cause issues with trees. So you have to base your rotation on the impacts to the land and to the trees. But they can also do great things for conversion over to a stubble pasture. So we were talking there at break about corrals. This is a picture of my corral, and I'll try to go through it. First off, it's in a hub, so it touches about 7 pastures. You can't see them all there. But when I design a corral, typically I'll put an alley all the way around it. In this case, I've got 2 alleys right here. And how many have seen the Canadian sorting video? Anybody seen that? It's where a guy stands. You got 2 alleys, and the guy stands right here. All right, and you got a board across or a high wire or whatever, but the cows aren't as afraid of you, so they come right on by you, and then the calves go down below that board, and you sort your cows and calves there. And you can do sheep the same way. It used to, when we had 300 cows, it'd take us a half day just to sort them to even start, because you don't want those calves in with the cows because they'll crush them when they're little. So that works really well. So it's just 2 alleys. They're all back here together, and you bring 10 or so down, and you just do this step thing. So here they come down, and here's the cows coming. You just do this, and the calves will back off, and the cows will come on by. So it really works well. So anyway, and then the other alley ends up at a tub, and then there's the head gate, and it faces 3 different sorting pens. You know, if you want to go back through, you just go through these back gates, and you're back in the alley. So it works real well. But when we're introducing a new species to the farm, you don't want to just let them off the trailer. I have a friend that just lowered the back gate and let some llamas off, and there went his cows about 3 farms over because they thought dinosaurs had been released, you know. But you typically might put the new ones in here, but run the main herd here. The guardian dogs are maybe the most problematic on the farm. And they'll be running up and down the fence row. Well, let's say the main herd's out here. And then the goats or sheep are in here with the guard dogs. They'll be running up and down the fence, and here's the cattle. And, you know, they're just getting used to what's going on here. And they find out that it's not a big problem before you release them. And it's up to you when you release them, at least 3 to 5 days. You know, this is the first introduction. After you have they're used to each other, you could release a new group in there that's not a different species right away. Break into hot wire. I don't have anything in here on it, but it would also be in here. So we just brought some pigs in, and they hadn't been next to hot wire. So just put you a hot wire around this woven wire on the inside and run the pigs or whatever it might be that you want to break to hot wire. And you put your feed right next to them, entice them to get close to it. And if you have problems with animals getting out, you may want to send them back in here for continuing education. Yeah, so that's I should have been drawing on that one there. But anyway, that's a closer view of it. This is when we first had goats years ago, 2006 or so. And we were more free range with the goats, and they were just seeking out. It was the beginning of a drought. And they were Kiko based, and I've raised a bunch of different breeds of goats, and Kiko's the ones that I had the best luck with. And there's just not, that's the one herd thing. We talked about that earlier. Do be watchful for pecking order, cattle first, then goats, and then sheep. sheep are the bottom of the pecking order. And there's where we might run a poly wire about 34 inches, like through a pigtail post, and you keep the cows back, and you can feed better hay to the sheep or goats. I've even run a wire about 40 inches, and it allowed the calves to go to better. So you can just step it right on down. So in this case, the sheep can get to all of the hay. You might have a bunch of hay out there, but the cattle can only get to what's within that 34-inch high wire. So a lot of room to play around with there. These are some feeders that I'll put some maybe alfalfa or sericea in and allow the sheep to get to it, but the cattle are excluded again with the hot wire. If cattle get next to those, it'll turn them over and they may kill some sheep or goats. Quick story on those. They're based on the Premier One design that you'll see on Premier One's website. My best one is one that has some wheels on the back. But when I first built them, I put a plywood bottom in them, and the sericea sheds a lot of leaves, alfalfa does too. Those leaves would hit that plywood bottom and nothing would in. Well, I knew from my training that the leaf was the best, so I said, I'm going to make them eat that because they're leaving the best stuff. Well, I did, and they died. They got listeria because it had gone through a bad fermentation by sitting there so long. Anyway, I switched over to these slick bottom troughs, and they clean up all the leaves. That's just a tin bottom on those. So there's my exclusion on some, those are Ketchum mineral feeders for goats or sheep, and that's just typically a one wire around it. Sheep can get to it, the cattle can't. I had a buddy and he was running multi-species, and he had to get rid of the sheep because the cattle wouldn't let them have any shade. Well, all he had to do was fence off an area that the cattle couldn't get to. With this one wire, the sheep would go under and have some shade. So, but he didn't know that, I guess. Oh, here's the sixth thing, so turn your head if you'd like. So here's the poly wire running up through there, and I like to fence that long direction like I talked to the other day and this morning. And here's, you can see the brown strip going up through there. That's where I just moved the fence. Instead of using a weed eater, I just moved the fence over where the animals had already grazed. And again, here's a idea of being able to travel on both sides of the fence. So I'll tend to do long fences, and I do long curves instead of putting in braces and all. I'll do long curves of fence and use bigger posts in the curve. That's the tire water. So putting blocks in these tanks is important. If they're deep water tanks, the lambs can die in there because they drown. In the worst case I ever had, the water level in the tank was low and they were leaning over too far and they fell over in the tank and they couldn't get out. But putting blocks in the tank helps them to escape.
Concrete blocks?
Concrete blocks, yeah. That's right. Yeah, and you need them on both sides of the tank. And I've tried ramps, and the ramps didn't work as well as the blocks. Just one big one. Just as long as they can get on top of it, because they're going to be swimming around.
Just under the surface?
Yeah, probably 4 to 6 inches below the surface. Yeah, so here's where I planted some cereal rye. I had a grazing specialist at my farm, friend, and he was critical of my residue. I didn't have enough residue on the ground, so I took that serious. So I planted cereal rye, knowing that it would produce a lot of residue. And if you want to get your residue up fast, plant some annuals in your grass and then just let a lot of it return to the ground to start that whole process. But, this slide's a little maybe hard to understand, but just due to everything, the rotation and the management of the grass and all, I used to spend $10,000 to $30,000 a year on, that was probably 250 acres of land to fertilize. Well, now we don't fertilize. I've used chicken litter once in 11, 12 years on most of the fields, and some fields hadn't been fertilized. Now, I say that, but I like for people to balance the fertility before they start this no fertilizer thing. Go ahead and get it balanced, and then the rotation, because we can cycle 80% to 90% of what, you know, what goes in the animal, 80 to 90% comes out. If it hits the right spot, then we've got a benefit there. And then the hay saving, because of the hay is fertilizer, we've got a big savings there. And we've been able to increase the stocking rate, like Idaho State said, by about 24%. This is a gardener I was working with, and he wanted control of the spiny amaranth. So I told him to use cereal rye. He actually used annual ryegrass, but he mulched the one on the left and not the right. And he did reps of this. He did three reps and had a control. And anyway, they all look just like this. So on the left, where he used a light mulch of annual ryegrass, he got no, it was the same as, you know, no, like 10%. Now, herbicides aren't even rated at 100%. They're like 90% controls, about as high as they get on the rating. So this did just as good as a herbicide would have done. That's why I was saying this morning that spiny amaranth is one of the easiest weeds to control. Now, annual ryegrass became his weed because it's very prolific and comes back from the mulch. It was supposed to use cereal rye, but anyway. So if you want to reduce spiny amaranth, if that's a problem on your farm, plant something, annual ryegrass, or it could be millet or sorghum, and you'll reduce it substantially. So overview of forage management considerations. Manage those minimum heights. My target grazing time, if I had my ideal, would be at boot stage, just like for hay. So right before the seed head emerges is my target grazing time. It's not so lush that they get the runs on it, and it's the best balance of biomass and nutrients in the grass. Keep light to the desirables, shade the undesirables. Try to keep that fertility right. Again, fence the long direction and plan for a hub in the operation, the common area. That's just a pretty picture I was just showing. I had a rented farm, had a bunch of sheep on it, had a bunch of donkeys. Didn't work so well with the donkeys. In fact, the predators got bad, and I had to move off of that farm with sheep and change it over to a cattle. That's wing stem standing there in the green. This was 2012, I believe, and it was real dry. And you can see that they're sharing. The cows are very, responsive. They don't run the sheep off in general unless something's of short supply. But you can see they get along. Sometimes the sheep will use the cows as shade. Here's some goats and how they've trimmed all the briars back to just a stem. And if they stayed in there, that stem would just get lower and lower. But they left all that grass and they're going for the stems. They also eat fescue seed heads better than even cattle. And the fescue seed carry that endophyte worse than the rest of the plant. So that's one way of cleaning up that endophyte. Of course, the goats are impacted some, but not as bad as cattle. Here's where I planted some corn and was for grazing. I just drilled corn, and it was feed bin corn, you know, feed corn. So it didn't cost hardly anything. But you need to have a high organic matter if you're not going to use fertilizer on the corn. So I'd say at least 4% organic matter. We just drilled it with a grain drill, had this drill like 50 pounds per acre, which is a real high rate. That's 150,000 plants per acre, but it only costs $7 an acre to plant it. So anyway, we turned them in. They're just grazing around the outside because they didn't know what that corn was. They figured it out later that day, and you can see that there's sheep and goats, and I've turned them into the next paddock, and the cows don't mind going off into thick, tall vegetation, but sheep and goats, being a prey species, don't want to go into that tall stuff. So it all works real well. That's where I just knocked it down with my Tacoma and put up a three-wire fence to strip graze it. They are back grazing back to water. So they naturally segregated. The sheep stay separate from the goats and the cows. So you'll see this over and over. And I drew that line that's in there. But the goats' heads are all up. Look how where I've drawn the line. The goats have their heads up high. The sheep are grazing what's on the ground, and the cattle are over in the corn. And they'll shuffle around in different areas, but they kind of keep that segregation thing going, staying. This is a steer that I finished, and I kept him too long. I would have, he was too fat, but it was on the corn. Yeah, and over 30 months, you know, you got to debone them if you go over 30 months. But anyway, it's just an example. This was grazed too low. They would have taken it to the dirt if I'd let them. They loved everything there. This is still 2012, and after we got rain, everything just went lush. So I don't like it to look like this. I don't want to harvest this much. I want to leave at least 50% of the biomass behind. Another thing about grazing management, if you rest it too long, you got brown leaf shade and green, that's reducing your solar panel. That's a little long rested for my blood right there. Not bad, but a little long rested. Goats and sheep can waste a lot of hay if you don't restrict their access. They also can turn it into this mushroom. The mushroom falls over and kills some of the sheep and goats. So you need some kind of restriction. They'll waste up to 50%. What's there. So this is another scene of showing the segregation. And again, that'll drift around. But it also shows how they'll separate on the landscape. Sheep tend to be on the steep, and the goats on the steep, and the cattle tend to like the flatter portions of the field. This is something I used to do, still do it a little bit, but it's just my technique of ear notching an ear tag for if I'd had problems. Red tag, first off, means I'm going to sell them. And then I'd notch the top of it if they had a messy tail. And then if they had bad famacha, I might ear notch the front of it. Had bad feet, the bottom of it, that kind of thing. Just a scene, that's one of my rams. Yeah, so this is November, and I like in the fall, I like to do the top third grazing. I like top third grazing all the time, but in the winter, I'll end up doing take half, leave half. So you graze through it one time, they soil it. In fact, I think the bison moved more on soiling the pasture than on how much grass was there. Once they had made it all dirty, it was time to move. They didn't want to be there. And again, that would be good for animal health to go on and move off. One thing about our grazing management with high density grazing, we're dropping a lot of manure. Coccidiosis can be an issue. So we need to go get on out of there once it's all soiled. I don't know if I'm saying that right for this part of the world. All right, so that's an old tobacco wagon, scapa wagon, and that's my mineral hanging high so the sheep can't get to it. And then I've got a common mineral, I think it's Redmond high selenium mineral that for sheep and goats. And then I do the exclusion mineral for the sheep. But I do feed copper off and on as needed to the small remnants. Here's just a picture of the hodgepodge. In fact, I sometimes worry when I've got all these different species out there, are the dogs just saying, it's a party, come on coyotes, join the party, you know. But yeah, there's pigs in this picture. I used to run them with the cows. It was just a few pigs. And now that I'm raising pigs in the woods and more separate, well, they are separate from the rest of the animals, those pigs don't look so good right there. But anyway, this is a before picture. One of the most poisonous weeds in the east is Perella mint, and that's it right there. Usually grows in the shade. Animals typically don't eat it, but if they do eat it, they'll usually die. So it's one to be aware of, but don't be scared to death of it, because they will avoid it unless they don't have anything else to eat. So this is a before picture. That's an after picture, and that's that Matua Brome I was talking about earlier. It's Persister is the name of it, and it's an improved Matua Brome. It does real well in the shade. That's the Perilla Mint in the winter after it's frosted. It dies back about September 15th in my area. And there may be a little annual ryegrass with that Persister Brome. One thing I don't think talked about enough is rumen fill. My rumen's real full right now. It's on the left side, right in front of the hips. And watch for it, especially when you're moving animals. When you rotate the animals, if that is indented at all, they didn't get enough to eat. So the rumen fill is real important on the production side. That's quantity. And then on quality of diet, you can tell a whole lot by looking at the manure, whether it was protein or if it was fibrous, it's stacking up, that kind of thing. So anyway, you can tell a lot just by looking at the animals and the manure. We're doing bale grazing now. We just set out bales and use rings, and we'll do that once a week. Whenever it's dry, get the bales out there, and then instead of the unrolling. Unrolling's still great, but it is a daily activity. I'm trying to reduce the labor a little bit. We use these quick couplers, and you just pop in the water hose, and you've got water. They're great for temporary water. I like the 55-gallon Rubbermaid trough and a Gallagher float. All the animals can use them. Works real well. They're not going to drown in those. Got this from Ian Michelinas, and it's just a chlorine tablet in a Gatorade bottle with slits cut in the middle of the bottle, and it floats in there and keeps the water somewhat clean. If you have a spring, you put this at the top of the spring, and it'll clean the whole pipeline. It doesn't mean that you won't be cleaning troughs, but it keeps the water a little cleaner. And there's still tadpoles in the troughs, so it's not a big issue. I don't think I have anything on this, but these ball waterers, you know, they're nice, and they're kind of pushed as being carefree and, maintenance-free and all, but they need to be drained. They'll go anaerobic. Like, drain them at least 3 times a year, maybe more, but drain them and you'll see black sludge come out of those things. So they keep your water clean, and I've even seen, particularly the Ritchie has a recessed ball. I'm sure there's others that have a recessed ball. It's kind of a possum trap. In fact, I worked with one farm, and a possum had fallen in there and made the cattle sick. Another thing is I have a lot of earthworms, and those earthworms, after a big rain, I'll pull a quart of earthworms out of these troughs. They travel the water up into that trough, and then they can't get out, and they die. So that makes it bad too. They're still great troughs, just need to drain them. Started using this apple cider vinegar. There's some 1940s research that says that it cures everything. Milk goes up, you got better, higher weight gains, on, and you know, a lot of humans are using some apple cider vinegar. But these folks have the best vinegar. It's twice as good as some of the other guys, so I'd recommend if you get it from these people, and I'm not associated with them at all. But if we're feeding it by itself, it would be a half gallon of vinegar, half gallon, we're using molasses too, half gallon of molasses, and then water, 30 gallons of water. And it's a nice little mix. And the molasses is high energy, and it's grass-fed approved. There's where they're drinking the vinegar. Now, that was half and half vinegar, half water, half vinegar. And it's like a wine tasting going on. Oh, the pigs. This is a few years back, but I got the pigs thinking they would root through the manure piles and break the fly cycle. Well, what they did is they'd go out in the pasture, find a fresh pile, and they'd roll in the manure. And then it's real thin, it desiccated, it did break the fly cycle, and then they'd find the water trough and jump in. I didn't really have that in plan. So this is my hogs now, and they've lined up for a bath there. They look a little better than the old pigs I used to raise. They were a little nervous that day. That's the tunneler that I was talking about on the dung beetles. That's, if you see that next to your manure, then that's a good thing. They're incorporating that manure in the ground. And I've done the numbers. I won't run through how I did it, but in with 100 cows on 1 acre for 5 to 10 days, because nitrogen can volatilize and losses of nitrogen, 5 to 10 days, you can more than fertilize a pasture with 100 cows on 1 acre. Doesn't have to be consecutive. You can fertilize any crop with the manure from the animals by them being there for 11 days, 22 days if it was volatilized nitrogen. So there's a lot of value in the nitrogen, or in the manure. It just depends on where it falls, whether it's an environmental hazard or a benefit. So keeping those animals moving is important in grazing management. There's another rule of thumb is don't allow the animals a second bite. So you don't want them to graze across the field and then start back over and graze it again. And that's kind of what they do. They pick the best and then they come back and pick next and next and next. That's why one of the biggest problems with continuous grazing is they pick all the ice cream grass, the best stuff, and leave the worst. And then eventually you end up with all of the grasses that just can tolerate low continuous grazing. This is a farm that was really just given to me to graze because it had been hayed so many years that it was nutrient depleted and wasn't worth cutting hay on anymore, so they let me graze it. And I just put up polywire because it's a day-to-day agreement. They may tell me any day that I need to be off of it. And that's where I own part of it now, and I, through feeding hay and I've spread some tobacco stalks on it. I think I even put chicken litter on it, and I've lined it. But you can see where the sheep are. I own that part. They've selected where the higher fertility ground is. And it's not just, and then the cows back in the back, the reason they're back there is I'm feeding some hay back there. Yeah.
Is that a panther?
Is it what?
Is that a panther?
Panther. Oh, yeah, it looks like a panther. It's a sheep. We have seen some panthers, we think. Yeah. They're so quick, I can't tell. This is a water point where we've just use gates or gate arrangement around it where we can rotate to all different fields and give them full access to the water point. And there's an aerial drawing of it. And all the blue lines, dark blue lines, are gates. About as cheap to put up gates, you know, economy gates, as it is to do panels and boards and all the labor. This is a gate arrangement where you got, anytime I use this real commonly, anytime I've got fields coming together and I want animals to move through that point, is have the gates come together but no post in the middle. You can rotate any direction with that. Real handy next to a corral. I don't have a drawing of it, but if you're putting up gates and let's just say the corners of these tables are gate position, hang them diagonal. Hang one over there and hang one where I am. Now we can rotate about every direction. If they're both hung over there, can't do much with that. So hang them diagonally to each other. I mean, it changes a lot. And I see it commonly where people hadn't done that. Predator control, I like a couple of dogs per minimum, and then one dog per 50 small ruminants. I like the Oshkosh or Anatolian Shepherd because they're shorter haired, easier to maintain. Anatolian have a name for being the most aggressive, one of the most aggressive dogs. I mainly have Oshkosh. I like some cattle with a little Brahma in them, like Santa Gertrudis, for they're a little more protected. So up here, I don't know if you'd want any Brahma blood. Grazing the woods, we already talked about that. It's okay, and they like goat grazing in the woods, but regrowth is just not there. and they can take it too far. So there's a reason to exclude them from their targeted grazing. I mentioned earlier about the sheep grazing buttercup. This is poison hemlock. Y'all have poison hemlock? Yeah, big, tall. It looks like wild carrot on steroids. It's supposedly very poisonous, but I've had a number of animals eat it and hadn't seen big issues. But I'm not saying it won't be. Seem like the goats eat it better than the cattle. And typically the small ruminants are more tolerant of toxins than cattle. Timing and marketing. If you're going to run small ruminants outside, then I like for them to birth in late March, early April. Here I would think it'd be April without shelter. Right? If you're in January, February, it could be a total disaster if you're lambing or kitten outside. Goats are more prone to hypothermia than sheep, and then of course then cattle would be next. We usually breed in November, and then with cattle we breed in May, and that's for the February 20th calves. And we'll join them together. This is the River Cottage Farm symbol, and might go on their website and look at what they have to offer, but most everything I produce is going through them now. Logo, that's the word I couldn't think of. So the potential, I think it's tremendous, the potential for running multi-species and agriculture in general right now because of the direct marketing like we heard this morning. It is a challenge and more time invested in the value added, but it's nice to be connected straight to the product. I'm not going to go through all those benefits, but there's a lot of benefits to just the land and the animals if we are observant of it all. So, you know, I've laid out a lot of ways to do it, but you know, in general, just do it. Just pay attention to those key little things, and don't worry too much about the layout and all. It can work no matter how it's laid out. What kind of fence you have doesn't matter that much as long as it contains the animals. Some things in holistic management they talk about is water cycle, mineral cycle, energy flow. Energy is a flow, not a cycle, unless we capture that carbon and get it into the cycle. And then the biological processes is the whole soil life and the animal life on top. Be willing to flex your stocking rate and density according to what vegetation you have. Grazing is half the cost of hay, and it's usually higher quality, so that's worth considering. Look at that rumen bill, look at the manure, and then be considerate of the pecking order as well. Got a few other photos. It's a rental house where we had some sheep on a pasture next to it. Used some cedars as bioengineering for erosion control. I put them in streams for stream revetments and trout cover. There's where we've unrolled some hay and for nutrient distribution. This is an adjoining landowner. You see the broom sedge, and then on the right is mine where we've managed more with high density, short duration, and then the feeding of the hay. This is Amber handle. I love these things. You can hook it up cold or hot. Works real well. I don't like the braid wire, poly braid. I know some people brag on it a lot, but that stuff kinks up. It's too heavy. It doesn't reel up very well. Mine even deteriorates, so I don't recommend the braid wire. This is just a funny picture where I mowed around this area, and the sheep, once they get going in a circle, if they can't see the other end, they just keep going. It's like, oh gosh, you're losing weight at this point. But yeah, so they won't stop. They'll do that in my corral too, but that alley, they'll just keep going. This is not a picture I'm real proud of, but I didn't have any shade in that pasture. Now there's no running water, but that is a stream bed where I was using it for shade. I do reseed it after they're in there, trying to keep it somewhat environmentally covered. And again, there's my pasture walk in the fall, and I do this the third Friday in October every year. So, is there time for questions, Titus?
We got 10.
All right. Any comments, questions? Yeah. Yeah, and some of the mineral companies now are...
Greg,
yeah.
Repeat the question. So
okay, yeah, good. Yeah, so earlier I mentioned garlic in the mineral for fly control, and I get it from webrestaurantstore.com. It's human-grade garlic powder, and I think it costs about $3 a pound, and then I'll add that to 50 pounds of mineral. And they consume it well, and yeah, we get great control of horn flies. Some of the mineral companies now are using that, and in fact, I buy from a Mennonite feed mill, and he said this year they're going to have a garlic cinnamon induced mineral and for fly control, and some have been selling that already, but yeah, it's worth considering. Any other questions? Yeah.
Could you comment or have any suggestions? I got some of that Perilla mint weed slipping out in the pasture. It's kind of getting out of the wood line and getting in the pasture. What's your control method?
Which weed is it?
That Beach State Perilla mint weed.
What is it again?
Perilla mint weed.
Oh, Perilla. Yeah, cool. Perilla mint. I'm more concerned about its shade than I am the toxicity. It has a big leaf on it and can shade a lot of grass. So control of it. One thing, first off, is it in my area, the best way to say it here is that it dies about a month prior to the last frost. Any weed I try to control before it goes to seed. Not that the seed bank's not already full of it, but it just seems to be a good technique. So you, and Perilla mint is one that you can mow below the bottom leaf and it'll die because it's an annual. It comes up in March or April. It comes up real early and it's a big leaf cotyledon. And you can just dig down in the grass. I see it in my grass, and the way to keep it down is to shade it. Don't let it ever get started. But it's very shade tolerant. Like you said, it grows in the edge of the woods usually. Another thing with weeds is it's a place to feed hay or mineral placement. You just trample it wherever it is. I'd rather not feed hay in the edge of the woods because I want my nutrients out on the pasture. And something new I've just started this year is I'm running the pigs on the edge of the pasture to tromp out undesirables. Another weed that's bad is Microstegium Japanese stiltgrass. Eulalia is another name. They're all the same thing. The naturalists hate that because it grows all in the woods. So I'm using those hogs to disturb that area, and then I'll reseed it to something else, this brome I was talking about. So it's a disturbance factor. You know, in cropland, we don't want disturbance because it's degrading to organic matter. In pasture land, we need a little disturbance to get things going sometimes. Grazing is a disturbance. Grazing increases disturbance increases diversity. So it's something to think about. Yeah, I guess that's all I got on the Perilla. Any other weeds that y'all have here that are problematic?
Mare's tail.
The sheep eat it pretty good. Cattle will eat it at a certain stage. But and the more, the higher the density grazing, the more they'll eat it. Mare's tail, I think the weed science people changed the name to horseweed, but it's a tough weed and it's Roundup resistant in their cropland a lot, and so it's an increasing plant. Palmer amaranth's a bad one in cropland, but cattle love it. The amaranths are 30% protein and like 80% TDN. They're out the roof in quality. So don't let cropland weeds throw you off as far as being weeds in pasture. It's different. Horse nettle's a terrible one. The sheep eat it pretty good. Not wonderful, but they eat it pretty good. Horse nettle is a nightshade like tomatoes. Yeah, of course, you know, the herbicide folks use Grazon for it. But Grazon, you know, carries over into the manure and kills broadleaves everywhere that manure goes for at least a year. So be aware of that. Don't spread that on your garden.
Okay.